The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to the After Thanksgiving edition of the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your overstuffed host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Gobble, gobble. How are you?
Fantastic.
How was your Thanksgiving?
It was wonderful.
Did you eat lots of turkey?
Of course I did.
We have brisket at our dinner along with turkey.
Oh, I like the options.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I don't eat brisket, but then my son-in-law doesn't eat turkey. So, hey, it all worked out. We had lots of food. Oh, my goodness. 15 people and lots of food. But I didn't have to go shopping.
Well, that turned out really well, didn't it?
I didn't have to cook. Yes, it did. Did you go shopping on Thursday?
Of course not.
Yeah.
Or Friday. I don't do that.
That's I don't. Yeah,
first of all.
Black Friday? Oh, yeah, me neither.
Wait, first, I'm a guy, so.
Well, there is that.
I got a whole month yet.
That's true. You have right up until that 24th of December, unless you're really good and can go out the morning of. Yeah, that's true. I'm well along in the gift, you know, area for the holiday
thanks,
coming up.
Thanks for helping the curve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're welcome. You're welcome. So I also want to tell our listening family, happy Thanksgiving. Hope you had a peaceful one. Hope you did not eat too much. And perhaps you even were able to get out for a ride. Well, I didn't. It was cold here. Cold and windy. Boy, the winds have been really nasty here.
Yeah, it was. I don't know if people got out for a ride. I know there were lots of people that played football.
Well, there is that. There's the Thanksgiving football thing.
The Turkey Bowl. There's a group that I usually go with that they've been doing it for over 35 years now.
Really?
And I learned after that period of time, I'm smart enough to know not to get up and do that on a Thursday morning.
Well, and you know that today, Saturday, is Small Business Saturday here in the U.S.
Yep.
Yeah. I still didn't go shopping. I'm sorry.
I bought a couple small things.
That's at the small business. Well, on our show this week, I decided to talk about leftovers.
You had any? With 15 people in the house?
Well, you know, there was plenty of food in this house. We are going to talk with our friend and consummate chef, Bijou Thomas. So he's going to be opening a brand new curry shop in Denver next week. But I asked him if he would take a break from the cooking and training he's doing in preparation for the grand opening to talk to us about leftovers. Because if anybody can figure out cool, interesting, healthy ways of using leftovers, it's Bijou Thomas. He is, after all, the author of the Feed Zone Cookbook, the Feed Zone Portables. He has fed more cyclists in the last year in Pelotons worldwide, from food trucks at cycling events, than anybody I know. Thousands of people have been making his Feed Zone Portables, the little things that get wrapped in the foil and stick them in the jersey pocket. Yeah, that's him. So we're going to talk with him. Then we are going to have some news, and most of it's good this week. You and I both were on the same page, evidently.
Yep, we'll stay away from the negative. It's Thanksgiving.
Exactly. And then you know where we're going?
Where?
Halfway.
Okay. We never do anything halfway around here, but I'll bite. Where?
All right. Halfway, Oregon, which is halfway.
Okay.
We're going to go speak with newly inducted Bicycle Hall of Famer Inga Thompson, one of my all-time favorite people. She is the three-time Olympian and outspoken critic of doping in cycling. She was inducted into the Bicycle Hall of Fame earlier this month, along with three other cycling luminaries. We did this interview, obviously, before Thanksgiving, so everybody could have the holiday off. And we got to talking. Things just got out of hand. So the interview is lengthy. We're going to split it into two parts. You'll hear the first part this week. And the second part next week, I wanted to make sure that we caught up with her and congratulated her on her induction into the Bicycle Hall of Fame. So if you're not too full, you can waddle on over to a comfortable chair. We're going to head on out to Colorado and speak with author and chef Bijou Thomas. Bijou, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Hi, it's great to be back. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's just great to talk with you. I haven't seen you since Dirt Demo 2 years ago.
Good Lord, has it been 2 years?
It has. Remember how hot and dusty it was? It was just really a weird day.
I do remember exactly how hot and dusty it was. It was about 105 degrees, and every time we turned around, there was a line as far as we could see of people waiting to get hot, spicy curry. on a 105-degree day outside.
And you're just trying to figure that out, right? Well, remember, we're dealing with cyclists here.
Yeah, exactly. So
I wanted to talk with you because you're the only person I know who could probably figure out what to do with leftovers that, like, isn't just a turkey sandwich.
Sure.
Everybody's been pigging out, and everybody gained some weight, but I think you could be more creative and healthy for us. Talk to us a little bit about what you're doing with some of the leftovers from a traditional and maybe some non-traditional Thanksgiving dinners.
Yeah, so, you know, there's all the standard stuff that everybody loves to do, from casseroles to omelets and soups and leftover turkey spaghetti or whatever else you do. But one of my favorite things, especially if you're, you know, if you're going to go for a hike or a bike ride, or it's off-season, so nobody's really out there trying to stuff their jerseys to jump in the middle of a race, unless you're doing a cross race. But even then, it might be a good idea. One of my favorite things to do is take basically a little bit of everything that you would want. Now dinner's over, so you can pick and choose, you know, all of your favorite stuff. Take a little bit of everything you want and make little burritos. And they're much, you know, more compact and easier to take on a hike or a bike ride or take for whatever it is you're going to do. And then you can kind of have it along with you instead of the classic sandwich. Just turning everything into a burrito just makes it a little bit more portable and easier to take.
Yum, yum. Yum, yum, yum. Okay. What else you got? What do you do with things like leftover cranberry sauce and leftover, you know, vegetables and stuff like that?
Well, one of I'm out here in Colorado, and in Colorado, any chance we get to turn something into a green chili, that's one of our favorite things. So obviously not the cranberries. Some of the vegetables you could definitely do, but the turkey and related stuff. And some, if you have diced potatoes, you saute all that up, fold in some green chilies. You could go with jalapenos. You can go with whatever level of heat you like. Roast a bunch of those in. Tomatillos, you know what those are, right?
The little, I do.
They look like tomatoes. I don't think they're part of the tomato family, but they look like tomatoes and they have that little skin. What you do with those guys, you dunk them in some hot water or just a quick boil and the skin peels right off. And you would put them in a blender, make a little sauce, and add that to some cooked turkey, some cooked vegetables, some jalapenos, whatever you have. Add a little bit of chicken stock, and all of a sudden you've got this fantastic turkey green chili that's literally, you know, what you already have plus chilies and tomatillos.
Wow, it sounds really yummy.
That is really good. And then especially because, you know, turkey Thanksgiving typically – most places, unless you're at my home or an Indian or a Latino family, you know, people like to keep it relatively unspicy.
True.
But in my home, we have, like, all the hot sauces come out, all the pickled peppers come out. The hotter we can make it, the better. So most people are ready for something with a little bit of a kick, a little spice, a little vinegar. I think making a turkey green chili is fantastic for that.
Yeah, it does sound really, really good. So are you working on any other cookbooks?
Yeah, actually, Al and I are working on the next Feed Zone book, which we got a little bit later start just because we've been super slammed with Scratch Labs, and then I'm in the middle of opening a restaurant. So we've just had a lot going on. So we are planning right now for the book to be released in time for Christmas a year from now.
Oh, okay.
Which will be perfect. By then, people will be ready for it.
And how will it be different from the Feed Zone book and the Feed Zone portable book that we have now?
Exactly. Unfortunately, I can't tell you.
Oh, yeah, then you'd have to kill me, right? Or poison me.
No, it's super secret. We're still kind of sharpening that a little bit. I don't want to give away too much, but it's awesome. It's a perfect book for, and with this one, Al and I wanted to take a little bit of a different direction with it and go more the direction that we personally like to eat and cook and entertain, which is we eat and cook and entertain in groups, whether that's a team, it's a family, it's, you know, your work organization, whatever it is, whether it's two people, six people, or 600 people. We want, with this next book, for people to see food and our ideas as being part of, you know, a little bit more of a social, with more of an interaction with the people in your life. You know, one of the things that we love to talk about is we've worked with tons of athletes and, you know, top teams over the years. And inevitably, regardless of what food is, the food's always going to be good. But what we've always found is the results definitely notch up. Every chance we get to just get the guys or the girls and the teams to just sit and eat together. So regardless of what the food is or what's on the menu, the bigger thing is just getting people to sit down together and enjoy meals. Just like, you know, Thanksgiving. It's just one of those things that feels better and you get better results if you can actually share it with somebody.
I'm speaking with Bijou Thomas. He is better known as Chef Bijou. He's in Denver, Colorado. We were talking about leftover Thanksgiving and his new book that's going to come out next Christmas. But I want to talk a little bit about the people you did feed this past year, because your portables ended up in the jersey pockets of damn near everybody on the Peloton last year. And then you fed thousands of people at events. So explain a little bit how that works, what you do, and how you make such huge amounts of food. And I know that you work in a really tiny space.
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up in the restaurant business, and I grew up kind of in a weird niche of it, which was I didn't do caterings, but I would do these massive events. In fact, in 2008, during President Obama's Democratic National Campaign, which was in Denver, we did back-to-back events for 1,200 people, 1,500 people, you know, every day, literally working out of a parking lot in the back of an alley downtown Denver. So for me, I've grown up for years learning just how to cook and how to scale to do events and do food for a lot of people. I think most people right now, you're looking at Thanksgiving, you got 10 or 15 people coming over, or maybe 20, and that's a lot of people packed into one house, especially when you have, you know, so many different dishes and so many different preferences and what people, you know, may or may not want to actually eat. And what I was able to do over the years was just learn how to do these massive events, huge amounts of food, but I would just really, really simplify the menu and the recipe, and which is why, you know, the Feed Zone, the first Feed Zone book, was really resonated with people, because it's literally three or four ingredients, one or two steps, and that's just how I cook. So when we started doing bigger and bigger events and Scratch Labs, you know, started taking off, and we had the opportunity to go and do, you know, we did a thing in Vegas last year where we probably fed, by the end of the day, close to 1,500 people. And we're working out of a tiny little, you know, our portable kitchen that we have at Scratch Labs. There's four of us cooking, and we crank out a ton of food. So, yeah, it's just been really awesome. Like, you can't do any of that unless you have really, really good people with you. So whether that's your mom and dad and your sisters this weekend in the kitchen, or if it's the crew that you hire, you just need one or two really good, solid people, and everything else is easy after that.
So now you're moving back into the restaurant business, and I know you're opening this curry shop, and we don't have, do we, Tim, have a curry shop in Cleveland? Okay, so explain what a curry shop is. Just fill us in on what that is as the last thing, and then we're going to let you go.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. So I grew up in the south of India, in Kerala, which not many people are familiar with. And if you go to Indian restaurants in the U.S., what you're getting is food that's typically from central India, which is Mumbai, or northern India, which is New Delhi, right. Those are the big areas. And the food, it's fantastic food, especially on really cold days. You get the warm naan, and you get the chicken curries, and all the spinach, and the cheese, and the dairy. It's really wonderful comfort food. Unfortunately, for me, as somebody who grew up in cycling, I would want to eat that and immediately go take a nap and not really want to do much after. It's much like having Thanksgiving dinner every day. The food that I personally grew up with is from the south of India, where it's super bright and tropical, and we don't cook with dairy. So the food that we eat is less heavy. It's really robust and bright and bursting with flavors, and we cook with beef and chicken and fish, tons of vegetables, and our sauces are typically either they're ground pesto, so we take fresh chilies fresh herbs. We cook a lot with fresh shallots and tamarind and green mangoes, and you grind it all up, you know, stone ground, just like you would a normal an Italian pesto with a mortar and pestle, or a mole in Mexican cultures. We, exact same thing, we grind it up. So we have different varying levels of heat and texture and colors, but they're all ground sauces. And the chicken and beef that I do, it's braised. So it's slow braised, so it's really tender, really ridiculously full of flavor. And we finish everything with coconut oil, and everything has a little bit of nuttiness and color. And it's unlike anything most people think of when they think of Indian food. So first and foremost, the food that we're doing is totally different. Curry Shop, I wanted to go with a name that anybody anywhere would recognize, which is called Little Curry Shop. And our idea is our first one's opening in Denver, then we've got one planned for Boulder coming up. And then after that, we're going to, you know, open them up nationwide. If people like it and people are willing to come in and eat with us, then I definitely want to open up a few around the country, and that's the plan.
How many people will this one seat, the Denver Shop?
So it's in a fast casual format where you walk through. Everything's made fresh, made from scratch daily in-house. In fact, when you're in, the kitchen is right there. So as you're walking in the restaurant, you'll see all the food being made. We have a big element of bicycles, because there's bicycles everywhere in India. So the artwork, a lot of the stuff around is just, you know, paintings and drawings of old school bikes that are all over India.
I'm looking at it. Tim's just showing me the picture of it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. That's a picture. My girlfriend and I were in India this last July, and we were at this fish market in Kovalam, which is right off the ocean where I'm from in South India. And that was for maybe like 7 in the morning. We were there, and that's one of the bicycles belonging to one of the vendors there. And I took a picture of it, and then a buddy of mine did an illustration. And that's yes. On our T-shirts and all of our material and everything. So, of course, we got to keep the bike scene going.
I should think so. How am I going to keep talking to you if you don't have some sort of a cycling thing? So are you going to come up with a cookbook out of the curry shop?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, we've got that in the works. That's going to be after the next feed zone. What I want to do, so the way that curry works is, you know, curry is a very generic term in India. In South India, where I'm from, anything that has a sauce, like a gravy, a thick sauce, would be considered a curry. But I figured that's a word that everybody knows and understands. So that's the name of our restaurant. It's Little Curry Shop. And our idea is to, you know, open them up here in Colorado first. And then we're making a big push into Madison after this, because some of my, you know, biggest supporters have been Madison folk. And
sure,
a huge cycling community in Madison. So I'd love to get some out there.
Cleveland has her hand up.
I'd love to get back out to Ohio, too. Well, Cleveland, Detroit, that region. Yeah, we'd love to be out there.
We would welcome you. Well, gee, I don't know. Maybe, Bishu, you just don't have enough to do, really.
No, I feel like I need more. So with our 2015 scratch schedule, which we've got a lot of cool stuff in the works for that, some great new products, we've got new books coming out. I'm going to get this place up and running, and we'll be up and running by end of next week. We'll be open, and then we'll be in full swing, you know, right around the first of the year.
So much good luck with the new store, with the new book. I mean, you're always a pleasure to talk with, and I, you know, always have such good ideas for food. And if it isn't for food, you know, what else is there to do? Eat to ride, ride to
Absolutely.
Eat. Have a great holiday. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Diane. Have a great afternoon.
Bye-bye. Bye. I always appreciate what Chef Bijou has to say.
It's great that even though we're not in the Peloton, we can use a lot of this great stuff.
Okay, so we're going to take a very short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to give you some good news. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back, and we're going to do some news.
Do you know your cycling rules of the road, Diane?
Oh, gee. Do I have to pass a test?
No, you don't have to. But okay.
I think I do.
On the telegraph.com.uk, they had a neat little quiz that you can take.
Oh, really?
If you're interested, the questions are, can cyclists ride two abreast? Are helmets compulsory? And things like that. So it's a neat little quick quiz that you can take. And of course, I took it and passed with flying colors.
Of course you did.
And I think this points out that every state is different and every place that we go is different. At least it's neat to see something.
You don't
like
think this. There are some universal rules? Well, first of all, they ride on the other side of the street in England.
Right.
So it always freaks me out when people pass on the left. I'm like, oh, I remember. That's because they ride over there. Yeah. So my first good story this week is about a 9-year-old. C.J. Burford from North Carolina just completed a transcontinental bike adventure on November 22nd, which was last weekend, to raise money for kids with cancer. This article was written for Bicycling Magazine by Taylor Rozek. Most 9-year-old boys are content to ride their bikes to the corner store and back, but not C.J. Burford. On December 22nd, C.J. finished his first ever cross-country bike ride. And from what we can tell, he is the youngest person ever to accomplish the feat. He started riding in Oceanside, California on September 1st. He's been averaging about 45 miles a day since. By the time he rolled into St. Augustine, Florida, he racked up 2,703 miles. Pretty impressive for a middle schooler. I think it's pretty impressive for anybody, really. CJ pedaled a Jameis Zenith Comp through the southern U.S. while his family accompanied him, whether by bike, as his dad most often does, or in the 1983 RV that his mother piloted alongside him with his 19-year-old sister and three brothers, ranging in age from 2 to 6. This is not a vacation, his mom Katie said when we spoke to her last week. It's more like a boys' locker room. I can imagine four boys under the age of, 10. CJ's ride was no vacation either. He was pedaling to raise money for kids with cancer. Though the final count isn't in yet, he's raised in the neighborhood of $25,000 for the National Children's Cancer Society, a cause that's close to his heart after watching his grandmother go through chemotherapy. So there's a little more to the article. It is, again, in Bicycling Magazine. The event ended. He dipped his front wheel into the Atlantic Ocean at St. Augustine on the 22nd of November. Well, you go, CJ. Good job.
Do you remember we talked about Zwift, the virtual training program?
Yeah.
This is for people that don't want to go transcontinental. They can stay in their living room or basement or wherever.
You know what Brian says? Trainer miles aren't real.
Well, these can lead to something that's real.
Okay, very good.
The co-founder of computer game training tool Zwift claims that 6 professional teams have promised contracts to players who show the most potential when the game goes live. They've had a huge amount of interest. There are actually 15,000 people on the waiting list for this software. And as we mentioned before, I know this in motorsports, Nissan has done this for several years. They take gamers and then they turn them into real race car drivers. They want to do this with the Zwift program. It's really neat to see this. They do have one slight challenge. They're having trouble making the steering and the turning to be more accurate. So once they figure that out, it'll be really good. But here's another great opportunity, maybe to find some new riders that will get them on a spot with a professional team.
That's cool. Okay. I'll buy that one.
Okay.
So this is another feel-good story, a really good one. Former Arizona Representative Gabby Giffords completed an 11-mile cycling event Saturday, marking another milestone in her recovery from a 2011 mass shooting. She was greeted with cheers and applause at the finish lines. This was at the Tour de Tucson. Alongside her husband, former astronaut Mark Kelly, Giffords crossed the finish line of El Tour de Tucson riding a recumbent bike. Organizers say some 9,000 people participate in the annual ride, which they call America's largest perimeter cycling event for cyclists of all ages and abilities. Giffords was an avid cyclist and athlete until she was critically injured by a gunshot wound to her head. In January 2011, Jared Lee Laufner opened fire at a Giffords meet and greet outside a Tucson supermarket, killing 6 people and injuring 17 others. Laufner pleaded guilty in 2012 and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Giffords' injuries forced her to resign from Congress. Earlier this year, and I didn't know this, she threw out the first pitch at the Congressional Women's Softball Game in Washington, a game she used to participate in. Kelly said his wife has been practicing for the Tucson ride and also uses a treadmill and rowing machine. It's important to stay active, and she wants to do everything she used to do before, Kelly told CNN affiliate KGUN. Giffords gets most of her pedaling power from her left leg, Kelly said, which makes it a little more difficult, but she's working really hard at it. She's hoping to do the 40 mile next year.
Good.
Yeah. So that was, I thought that was a really, really good story.
Okay, another positive story.
Oh, good.
Arthur Fedosayev of the Astana Continental Team has tested positive.
That's fine.
For the use of anabolic androgenic steroids. The UCI
Why is
confirmed
this a feel-good
Wednesday.
Story?
I didn't say feel-good. Oh. We said positive.
Oh.
The Kazakhstani rider's positive sample was collected at the Tour de Lane in August and is just another name to add to the doping. So this is the weekly. This is five now.
Well, I was just going to say this is five because it was four last week.
Yes. So we're now up to five.
So being the girly girl that I am, mm-hmm. yeah, I was smitten with this collection of useful and not necessarily necessary items on a website called TotalWomenCycling.com. So there are about a dozen of these little items. Some of them are not yet available. One of these is. The other one isn't that I'm going to tell you about. And then if you want, you can always go to TotalWomenCycling.com. So the first is a little bicycle vase. It is made from a 3D printer. The bicycle vase plants attach securely to your handlebar or frame. So you know how in Volkswagens,
yeah.
they have a little... Okay, you can put one on your bike so that you can have a flower. It gives your bike a little added decoration. And if you are also afraid that people might steal it from your bike, it has a flat bottom. So you can take it off and then put it on your desk and then put it back on before you go home. And then there's the springtime picnic basket. So picnics for cyclists can be a bit of a pain as there's never enough room to carry everything you need. And then you're faced with having to perch on a bench covered in prehistoric bird poo. That's what they're saying. I'm just reading this. Or pretend to act comfortable sitting on the itchy pollen-filled grass because you forgot to bring a blanket to sit on. But there is another answer. Springtime is a picnic basket that attaches nicely to your bicycle rack, holds a table for two, two chairs, and heaps of space for the picnic food essentials and a bottle or two.
That sounds like plenty for a picnic.
It's very clever. Yeah. So again, it's TotalWomenCycling.com, and just look for the coolest bike gadgets if you want to see them.
The top cycling teams unite under one umbrella. This is a positive thing. In a carefully orchestrated rollout early Tuesday, the collaborating teams issued a statement in which they say they hope to improve the sport by better organizing the schedule, incorporating new technology, and creating a more sustainable business model. Now, 11 of the world's leading cycling teams have formed a group called Velon, V-E-L-O-N, a business venture that is designed just to more of a PR.
Yeah, promote.
And
these teams.
Right. It's going to help with management and questions about overall integrity. Now, it doesn't have all the teams that are involved, but it has enough involved that I think this is going to move forward and help to shape the sport. And
we'll watch it.
In a positive way.
We will watch it. All right. My video of the week. It's just nuts. In an attempt to see which of four bikes might travel the farthest in a bungee jumping type contest, Wiggle, which is an online retailer in the UK, launched bikes and riders off of a mountain. It's truly nuts. It was just crazy. I'm looking at it going, oh my goodness, no way. This is by Simon McMichael for road.cc. And Simon says, I've never been able to say that. Simon says, here's something you won't see in a road CC bike test yet. How far a bike can travel through the air. Wiggle have tried it, though, with four different, very different models, launching them and their riders off what resembles a ski jump off the side of a mountain in the French Alps. Fortunately, the riders, carrying weights where necessary to ensure like is being compared with like, so that the girl who was there would weigh the same as the guys.
Right.
Are attached to bungee cords. But even so, some of the facial expressions in the video of this exercise are priceless as they plummet into the ravine. I'm telling you, this is terrifying. Watch to find out which bike and rider flies through the air with the greatest of ease, and road.cc bike reviewers be warned. Site editor Tony was last seen, hammer in hand, heading off to Cheddar Gorge in a van laden with sheets of plywood planks and of wood and coils of super thick elastic cord. It's 3 minutes and 49 seconds of, I think, absolute terror.
It is, and I think what makes it great, and it's just the onboard cameras that they have showing their faces. And
you know, they've got them, like, zip-lined in,
yeah.
And it's like...
a safety line on either side, and right. then their zip line and tied off to that. Yet they still have to go down this ski ramp and just launch into the air, and you get to the end, and it's like, oh, crap.
There's nothing there.
There's just, and really, it is, it's really cool. I found it on the Wiggle YouTube page.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. All right. I think on that note, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back, and we'll talk with my buddy Inga Thompson somewhere in halfway Oregon. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
We're going to head out to halfway Oregon to hear the first half of an interview with my good friend and newly inducted Hall of Fame person, Miss Inga Thompson. Hi, Inga. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy holidays.
Hi, Diane. It's always a joy to get to speak with you.
So I was looking, speaking of feel good, for a feel good story this week, and you are the first person to have popped into my mind.
That's funny.
Last month, along with three other, or actually it was this month, along with three other cycling luminaries, you were inducted into the Bicycle Hall of Fame. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. It really was. It was such an honor. It really was kind of a nice way to finally end the career. It was great.
You know what? You deserve it. You so deserve it. Tell me a little bit about the ceremony in the evening, how it went. And there were three other people inducted along with you?
Yes, there were. It was Sarah Valentine. She was a mountain biker. Great, great woman who does also a lot of mountaineering. And she just had some wonderful stories about, you know, doing some major, I think it was like the world championships. And the day before, she had climbed the Eiger and how excited she was.
The day before the ceremony?
No, not before the ceremony. This was like a day before the world championships or something like that. And they're like, oh, it's great to be at the world. She's like, yeah, but I got to climb the Eiger.
Like, let's get our priorities straight here.
That's exactly what it was. You know, she's a backcountry skier. And I'm a backcountry skier. And I just love the woman. It was wonderful. And then the two other gentlemen were deceased. Oh, but to hear their stories about, like, when it was, you know, doing the 7-day racing over in Europe and what they would go through. And I think, you know, something like 3,000, I can't, don't quote me on the number, but it was something incredible about it. 3,000 miles were raced in 7 days of that 7-day racing. And it just sounded brutal.
And yeah, it does.
That was amazing. You know, one guy had crashed so hard that when he finally, like, woke up mentally, you know, he was back over in the States just kind of wandering around in the streets.
Wow. And,
I know.
Wow. Today they would call that a concussion and maybe we should keep you in the hospital a little longer.
Yeah, hence the making of the new Skyrim helmets.
Exactly, exactly. And who was the fourth person?
It was Jerry Castle.
Okay.
And, you know, and he was a contributor for putting on some great, great races. And, you know, and being one of the major players of getting that bicycle racing, you know, going in the States. And the other one was Charles Winter, was the guy who did the 7-day racing. You know, it's so neat to see how our sport has evolved and how we've gotten where we've gotten. And just and so much passion from so many people. It's you realize just here as humans, you know, here bicycle racing, it really is, I call it a privilege. It's not a right. And to me, the psychology behind us being humans, you know, we just don't, you know, live, breathe, eat, go to work and stuff like that. Our lives are filled with passion and that's things we want to do. And, you know, to watch the passion of these different men that put together races, you know, and it's not just about the racers. It's about the people with that passion to make it happen, because not all of us can be race organizers or directors or stuff like that, but it takes that equal passion of those people. I know I keep using that word again and again, but that's what really struck me, is these different you know, people that have put together all these races for us to get to go have the privilege of racing our bike.
I wanted to ask you, I mean, I'm sure you sat through the ceremony that evening and people talked about your career. When you look back, how does your racing career look to you in retrospect? What does it mean to you, and what do you see your role in our sport was?
You know, this has been interesting to look back in retrospect, because when I left the sport, I was angry, I was mad, you know, kind of felt like I'd been cheated, frustrated, and I also felt, I felt like a failure. I felt like I had never quite made it. I was so close, you know, and left it discouraged.
What do you mean you didn't quite make it? Missed three-time Olympian.
I knew that I had the potential to be a gold medalist and not a lot of silver medals. And I knew I had that. And, you know, and it's one of those things where, and I, in some ways, even now, also, I'll get to the positive side of this, but even now I still have even that much more regret, because, it, you know, age makes us wiser. And I look back and I think I had that, I call it the little perfect storm to be the best in the world again and again, you know, lots of different things like, yeah, I was a good runner, but I wasn't great. I was too tall, but I got onto a bike and I have super long femurs and, you know, a short body. And so I had the perfect, you know, mechanical to be on a bike. And I also had, you know, when I looked back up and I didn't understand hematocrit levels until a couple of years ago when this whole blood doping thing came out, and I looked at my natural hematocrit levels and it was 47%, you know, I mean, it was way up there. And that explained why I was called a genetic fluke by the coaches, is that they knew what that meant. And, you know, and it's the way I carry the red blood cells. And it's also, the other thing you want to factor in is I had the passion for a bike. I didn't have a passion to be a basketball player, a volleyball player. I had the passion of the bike. I was so wrapped up in the sport, steeping with history of racing in the Tour de France and racing again and again, day after day at the Tour and stuff like that. Just, I mean, it turned me on. It got me going. It's like, yeah, I want to do this. And see, looking back in hindsight, I realized I had that perfect storm of attributes that there should have been so much more. And yet I also look back and I look at the drugs that were going on at the time. And now I'm going, wow, I can't believe I got the results that I did. And I was there. And anymore now, like, you know, I go off and I do these little rides with my friends now and constantly getting, you know, spit off the back again and again. It makes me chuckle because I'm thinking, wow, there was a time that I was at the person putting the hurt on everyone and dropping them, stuff like that. And I don't think it was until now that I'm like, that I really kind of understand the type of fitness that I had at that time and what I could do. It's really been getting shelled out the back that's made me appreciate it.
I'm speaking with Inga Thompson. We are talking about her induction into the Bicycle Hall of Fame, her career. And do you have any regrets? I know why you quit. I know when you quit. I know what might have been ahead of you. But looking back now, do you have regrets? Is there a race you didn't enter or a competition you wish you had won?
Yeah, I wish I had fought harder to get into more of the women's Tour de France's. And I look around at some, maybe a lot of more of the local races I wish I had done. You hear about some of these different hill climbs that go on, and I'm thinking, I really wish I had taken the time to go to those. And, you know, just because I live here, and it would have been fun. Like, I love going back to Nevada City, the race that gets there, because I got to race that one and win it. And, you know, it's in my back door. You know, wish I had tried to do the hour record. Really wish I had tried that. And yet, I also got to do all the great big races. I really got to do just about everything. And so in that sense, there aren't any regrets. But, you know, some of the things I look back, you know, I got to live, eat, and breathe it. I got to make a living racing my bike, you know, how I bought this cattle ranch up here. And I look at that and, you know, I feel pretty blessed in hindsight that I got to do what I was able to do and make a living at it. Because I watch the women now struggling to make ends meet. And I'm thinking, wow, was I spoiled?
Well, it was a different era. I wouldn't say you were spoiled. You were part of the group. Everybody had that opportunity then. I don't know how it's changed so dramatically, and it would be nice to see it come back. And I think it's starting back up again. The pendulum is swinging in the other direction finally, I think. Yes?
I think so. You know, it's kind of excited to see, like, Rob and Serena put together the Women's Cycling Organization. I want to be part of that. You know, watching what Catherine Bertrand has done with doing her little movie, The Half the Road, and what a great reception that has. And I suddenly see this potential for women to be major players in the sport. Instead of, you know, begging for, you know, would you give us a race here or there? I actually see the potential that for them to see us as the next, I hate saying this, but the next cash cow of, if we actually promoted this sport, women could really, really thrive under it. And in the same way that, you know, think about women's tennis.
Right.
And now, you know, half the people are there to watch the women's tennis. They're not there just to watch the men. They're there to watch the women. And when you watch the women in bike racing, our racing is really exciting. There's a lot of really powerful women out there. I mean, I look at it like, you know, the depth is there. There's a lot of different women racing where, you know, before when I was racing, it was like, you know, long ago, just, you know, winning everything.
Well, Marianne Vos is kind of doing that too.
Yeah, she is.
But that's another story. But you're right. You're right. It was Jeannie Longo and everybody else.
Yeah, and now, you know, Vos seems to be outspoken for the women, and maybe there's a tide changing here. And if, you know, a couple of the women's organizations can get together and I think go and to the UCI. Yeah, like the quote that I really got a chuckle out of is Brian Cookson saying, well, you know, we'll see how the sports develop, you know, before they do anything. And my attitude is, you know, 20 years later, nothing has done it. And that's a reflection of the UCI, because it is your job to develop the sport. So if nothing has changed in 20 years, it means you haven't done your job. It's not this answer of, well, we'll see how it develops. The answer should be, you know what? Nothing's happened in 20 years. Maybe we should get our act together and be promoting this sport.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. You'll remember Alexi Graywall.
Uh-huh.
And there was some talk this past week that the UCI was thinking, or somebody was thinking, of shortening the Grand Tours. So either make each race shorter, but Alexi came out with a really good idea. And he said, take the three Grand Tours, the Tour, the Giro, and the Vuelta, and schedule two a year, replacing the third one each year with a woman's Grand Tour, a two-week Grand Tour for women. So alternating each year. So you have the Tour and the Giro and a woman's race one year. You have the Giro and the Vuelta, and then you have the Tour. And I just thought that was such an interesting idea. What do you think?
You know, I was torn on that one. I read that, and I thought about it for a long time. And part of me is like, oh, my God, if we could get the women in there, that would be incredible. It would be such a great introduction. And then at the same time, it was like, wow, here we are, you know, kind of going for crumbs again of, well, we get put in there once every 3 years.
No. They're every year.
Oh, so he was saying have it in every year for the women?
Yeah, so whichever Grand Tour is dropped out that year, the women's race is that year. But there's women every year for 2 weeks. No, I didn't read it that way, that they would only be every third year.
All right. Okay, so I misread it wrong. That was about a week ago. Yeah, and I think it'd be a great way to get the women in there. Some of the things that also crossed my mind as well was, you know, that these tours keep getting longer and longer and harder and harder. I didn't fact check this before the interview, but I thought maybe if this is what's happening, they keep getting longer and harder. Maybe this is some of the stuff that's pushing the doping even harder, because they've almost made it impossible to do all these different tours.
Right. They need squads. They can't even do two or three of the events because they're just so grueling. So that was the idea of shortening them, which was the other side of it. And then somebody in Italy said, no, we don't want them shorter. But I'm not sure it isn't a bad idea to make it a little less daunting and then add women anyway.
And the women should be in there anyway. Like, you know, one of the things that I'd like to start push for is if it's a certain caliber race on the International Cycling Union calendar, then it has to have a women's race. And if they want to start off slow, okay, so if they have, you know, 3 weeks of racing for the men, then have 2 weeks for the women. You know, that's what they did with us with the Tour de France, where we would start racing, I think it'd be 2 weeks out of the 3 weeks. And
I like that.
And so it's like if they're already at that level, they're already highly successful. And part of giving back to the sport is you just don't get to have your event. You also need to put on a women's event because we are, last I checked, half of the population of the world.
And the most important half, you know, in our opinion. But then, of course, we're us.
I know. And then you look at it, too. It's like we are half of the consumers. We are half of everything. And so they say, oh, nobody will watch it. Well, you know what? I'd be watching it.
Oh, me too. Heck yeah.
And I think, you know, half of the population that would now be, you're not just like, you're not distracting for the men. You're adding to the whole event because you're bringing, you're missing out on half of the population that would like to watch this.
Well, you also have cyclocross, which is getting huge. You also have mountain bike racing. And now you have television, which, of course, is probably the most important thing to move the sport larger and into more people's homes. And the women are doing so well in all disciplines of cycling.
Yeah. Well, I've always kind of felt that a woman is in some ways, you know, more genetically engineered to race a bicycle, you know, because it is that day after day after day. And we have those, you know, natural fat reserves that you can draw off of. But, you know, it's like, you know, we were racing, you know, even at 10%, we're incredibly lean. But I think it can also make a difference to, you know, and they also show that women have more natural endurance. I mean, you look at some of these, the woman who, is it Christy Wellington that placed up there with the man in the Ironman? It's amazing watching what that woman has done. She is so close. And if you were to think that if it's more mainstream for little girls to look at it and go, yeah, I could be doing that too. But, you know, the really young girls really aren't getting recruited like the young boys. Like all the young boys are recruited to get into football and soccer and this and that. And a lot of little girls aren't really getting recruited like the boys. And if, there's more sports out there for the women, more of these little young girls are going to get recruited, and you just have that bigger of a gene pool to draw from. I mean, I get a kick now out of watching women's sports, even here in our little town, or around, you know, the girls who really, really get into these sports because it means a college education for them because of Title IX.
Right.
You know, Title IX is educating a lot of young girls because of sports. And, you know, and that one's, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to say slow to get going, but what has that been at now? Maybe close to 30 years?
Oh, yeah, probably. Yeah, I would say so. I don't remember the exact date, but boy, I can remember the announcement.
And the women's sports keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's been kind of slow to get going, but it's going. And, you know, and one day I kind of see an equal foothold for the women in there, and they're no less difference than the battles that we have going on for, you know, that you see the discrepancies of, in pay for women in the work field. And it's, I think it's going to be one of those things like, but of course, I think about the fight that was put on in order for women to be able to vote. It was a huge fight.
Right.
And now we look at it and we go, but of course, the women should be able to vote. Everything should be, but of course, you know, we should be there. And I'm hoping one day with the women in the sports, and specifically my passion of cycling, is like, but of course there's a women's Tour de France and a Giro
exactly.
and a Vuelta.
Like, why wouldn't there be?
Why wouldn't there be?
Right.
That, you know, that's is like to say, okay, there's no more women's Wimbledon. You'd be like, what?
Yes.
You know?
Well, that's a very good example. You know, I happen to watch golf, and I was watching an LPGA young, literally 17-year-old girl win a tournament yesterday, and I'm like, oh my goodness, 17, and you know, she's shooting like way under par, and we've got young girls who can get on a bike and ride like she can play. I know it's true.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but I'm a terrible golfer. I went golfing the other day for the very first time. I couldn't even hit the stinking ball.
Wait a minute. I have not yet tried to play. I grew up in a golfing family, but I'm left-handed, so they wouldn't let me play. Yeah, we're not going anywhere with Masters Golf, which takes me to the subject of Masters Cycling. How come you're not entering Masters Cycling? Why have you not looked back at the sport at, you know, this stage? It's like you have nothing else to do, right?
No, I've spent the last, you know, 20 years raising my son and raising him on a ranch, and it's rural and it's isolated, and last I checked, I was the only cyclist here. Really just kind of busy doing something absolutely, completely different. You know, one of the reasons why I came here, there's a lot of different reasons. It was a love of mine to farm with my horses. But it was also a great avenue to absolutely get completely away from cycling. I just, it was too painful to watch it. You know, like a couple times it'd pop up on the TV, and when you know everybody and you know the story, it just, it was too emotional for me. So it was really fun to come live in this little town of Halfway because nobody even knew I was a cyclist, you know, if it wasn't football or baseball, it wasn't a real sport, you know, and it was just a great way for me to hide. Nobody asked questions and nobody was interested, you know. It's really kind of a you know, patriarchal community here, and so, you know, women in sports, you know, is like, oh yeah, that girl that, yeah, they just didn't even recognize it. And that made me feel comfortable. I never had to speak about it. And so, you know, but now with my son raised and off at college, it's kind of not just really crossed my mind, but I'm thinking a lot about, you know, getting in and working with the young girls, because we at the Hall of Fame got to ride with some young riders there. And it was like, oh, it was such a joy to see their faces and light up and out there riding their bikes and training hard. I was just like, wow, it was just so neat to see this new young generation coming up. And if there's, you know, for me, that love of cycling is coming back, and it would be fun to get to work with those kids.
You know, there is a group, and we've talked about this before. We had this conversation the last time we talked. There are a group of women who are sort of just like you. They may or may not have the results you've had, but they all got on a bike. They all raced bikes. They've all retired, and they're all looking at what it is they need or want or maybe even should give back to the sport. So I think there is a role for people like Inga Thompson to come back in.
Yeah, you know, once again, you know, the beauty of getting older is looking back in hindsight, and, you know, and some of those things that I wish I had known back then, well, now I do know. And the other thing too is I'm older and wiser. I'm not intimidated by the big players like I used to be. You know, back when I was racing, all I want to do is just race my bike, you know, and you didn't want to do anything that would hurt your career. And, you know, now I don't have a career I have to worry about. I'm not involved. I don't have like anything to do with cycling as far as making a living or promoting a sport or event. And I thought, what a great venue for me to be able to get into the sport and fight for women, because I don't have an agenda of a race that I'm promoting or a business that I'm promoting or a career that I'm promoting, that I can really fight for the women. And I remember when I was racing, I always wished that there was somebody who would fight for us, that would promote us, that would, you know, help us bring our sport to the forefront. And I'm thinking, well, maybe I can be one of those women. I don't believe I can do it by myself. I think it would take a collaborative effort. You know, and I know we've talked before about doing grand fondos and stuff, and I'm like, I'd like to think bigger than that. You know, instead of just putting on some neat, you know, really great big race, if you put that effort into actually making sure that the women get onto all of these big grand tour calendars and to fight for women, yeah, to have a race at every one of these races, I want to think bigger, because I'm of the belief of build it and they will come.
I agree with you.
Somebody asked me, how did you get into women's racing? You know, you want to know how I got into it? It wasn't somebody saying, hey, get on a bike, you look like you'd be pretty good. That did happen. I had lots of people encouraging me to get on a bike, because I'd ride my dad's old Schwinn back and forth from school. And, you know, and I was passing a lot of the bike racers out there on there. Like, I had all these school books in the back, and I'd pass them. I'd be like, hey, guys, how's it going? You know, I'm riding this, you know, 50-pound clunker. And they tried to get me into bike racing, and it didn't bite. And what bit was, I was watching the news with my dad during the 84 Winter Olympics when they had this announcement. There's going to be the first ever women's Tour de France.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I was awestruck. I remember looking at my dad going, did I hear that right? He goes, yeah. And I'm like, they have a women's Tour de France? I'm doing it. I'm doing that this year. I'm going to the women's Tour de France. You know what? I went down and went to the bike shop, and I had saved up this $1,400 because I wanted to go over to New Zealand and work on a cattle ranch, you know, and that was the price of the ticket. And I went down there, I'm like, they have a women's Tour de France. And some guys in the bike shop said, women can't do that.
Well, that's what you needed to hear, right?
Women can't do that. That's all I need to hear. And the next thing, and then the bike owner said, and I said something about, you know, I had this $1,400, and I still remember it was Stuart Hunt Cycles there with Jim Patterson. And he goes, I'll build you a nice Italian racing frame with, you know, with Nuvo Record Campagnola for $1,400. And I said, done.
Right. Heck yeah. Why wouldn't we like to do that today?
Yeah. And that's how I got into bike racing, was this combination. The day before, they said there's a women's Tour de France, and I went down to a local bike shop, and they said, women can't do that. And I'm like, just you watch me. And and I'm still just, one of the disappointments was, you know, 3 months later, I made an Olympic team, which was really awesome. Maybe it was 4 months later, but in the back of my mind, I was like, they're like, well, if you're on the women's Olympic team, you can't go to the women's Tour de France. I'm like, what? What do you mean I can't go to the Women's Tour de France? That's why I got into bike racing.
Because of the Pro-Am thing?
And because it was at the same time or something like that.
Oh.
And I remember talking to my dad, you know, because I wanted to do the Tour de France. He goes, you know, the Tour de France will be there next year, but this is the first ever Women's Olympics. You really ought to do the Olympics. I'm like, okay. You know, and so my dad talked me into the Olympics, but like I said, I want to do the Tour de France. But that's how I got into it, is that they said, there was a women's Tour de France. And so back to my idea of build it and they will come. So with these, you know, women, if they knew that they had all these grand tours and they knew that they could have, I mean, I hate to say it, but we are driven by, you know, success and press and, you know.
Sure.
And results. And if these women thought that they were up there on the podiums like the men were up there on the podiums, build it and they will come. But if the women are limited to doing, you know, local small races,
for no money.
Yeah, for no money, it's hard to bring the women in. And one of my things that I would really like to do, I was speaking with a guy at a big corporation, and they were talking about how cycling had really burned them. Actually, it was Nike. And I got to sit next to at one of my mom's dinners. It was like a cousin to Phil Knight. And he was talking about how they had been burned by cycling and they never wanted to get into it again because of, you know, Lance and the doping and how they lost money at it. And it was heartbreaking to see this sponsor never, ever wanting to have anything to do with cycling. And I talked to him and I said, yeah, but, and so he went on to say, what we want is it's not about, you know, promoting a athlete or promoting an event anymore for them with cycling, or I'll take cycling out of it, is like, you know, to promote the advancement of the sport or the advancement of, you know, of athletes. And then that kind of in the back of my mind, I'm like, man, I really want to go to these guys and say, what would you think about promoting, you know, women's cycling? You won't make any money off of the women selling apparel or stuff like that. But if they came in there and they said, for all of these grand tours, we are going to offer equal prize money for the women. Now you've turned a women's sport around. You could put your chase back into cycling with a different venue of turning women's sport, you know, turning specifically women's cycling into huge, just absolutely huge for the women. And they would be the ones that could do this, you know, by offering the equal prize money. And, you know, and then hopefully, you know, women like me, this group we're talking about, you know, like the Women's Cycling Organization, to get the UCI to make sure that that there are women events at the Grand Tours, and you have some big sponsor come in and say, okay, and we're going to make sure that the women have equal prize money. Can't you see a little bit of a perfect storm going on here to put women's racing onto the map?
I think it's on its way. Inga Thompson joined me from her home in Halfway, Oregon. What a fabulous, fabulous interview and conversation. I just love talking with her. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I hope you have a chance to go for a ride. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.